Welcome to The Telegram. I'm Tim Stanley. Democracy in Egypt has fallen apart. It raises the question, can it work anywhere in the Arab world? Also, salmon wrapped in gold foil and sugar plum sauce. What lavish Christmas menus unveiled this week tell us about Britain's two-speed economy. I'm joined in the studio by Con Coughlan, the Telegraph's defence editor, by Shashank Joshi, a research fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, and by Steve Hawkes, the Telegraph's consumer affairs editor. The Arab Spring was a moment of hope and possibility for the Arab world. 2 years later, and it's all in chaos. The civil war in Syria, strife in Yemen and Libya, and now President Morsi, the first democratically elected president of Egypt, has been removed in a coup. Good for the military, say many in Egypt and the West, for Morsi is widely understood to have been incompetent and dictatorial, but it's a funny kind of democratic revolution that unseats elected leaders with violent demonstrations and military force. So is the democratic experiment in Egypt really over? And did it ever stand a chance of success in the first place? Shashank Joshi, can you explain to us why Morsi was kicked out of office?
Sure, there's a long list of reasons. It goes back to November 2012 when he issued a constitutional declaration, essentially putting himself above the law. That was quickly reversed, but I think it set all the signs that this is not someone who's able to govern inclusively. He can't really follow the rules of the road and he's bending these to his own advantage. But what really broke the straw on the camel's back is mass protests over 3 or 4 days, rivaling anything we saw in 2011 against Mubarak. And it wasn't the fact that he was an Islamist that irked these crowds. That was part of it. It was the fact that he couldn't govern Egypt in a more basic, fundamental sense. He couldn't fix the economy. He couldn't bring accountability to the police. He couldn't fulfill any of his promises. And all the while, he was engaged in this perpetual tussle with his opponents, who he vilified as traitors. And really, it's not about Islamism. It's about anti-Muslim Brotherhood sentiment finally reaching breaking point.
So how much was this simply an economic protest?
It's difficult to put percentages on it, but I think the fact that Egypt's economy is in such an absolutely staggering mess played a very substantial role in provoking the so-called Tamarod movement, which got 22 million signatures against him, which actually had nothing to do with the organised opposition, who were seen as out of touch and irrelevant.
Okay. Now, Con, were we too excited about the Arab Spring when it first happened? Should we have seen this coming?
Well, as I said from the start, there's no such thing as an Arab Spring.
Right.
Because the Arab Spring suggests that the peoples of the Arab world, all the peoples of the Arab world, are hell-bent on democracy. And as we've seen over the last 2 years, democracy has fallen very much down the agenda. And you've seen Islamist groups taking it over and using it for their own purposes. And of course, one of the themes of the whole Morsi debacle was he was becoming more and more autocratic. The Muslim Brotherhood were dictating a far more Islamist agenda than the people who originally took to Tahrir Square in 2011 envisaged. And so apart, as Shashank says, apart from the economic travails, the sense of claustrophobia that was taking root in Cairo was a very important factor. And the reason that people are cheering in the streets of Cairo today is as much because they are shaking off the shackles of Islamist rule as looking forward to a better economic future.
Now, surely there was an Arab Spring in the sense that a group of dictators who were the last vestiges of the Cold War were overthrown. Now, we might not like what it was they were replaced with, but that is in and of itself a popular revolution.
Yes, but I think it's rather patronising of the Arab world to link all the uprisings that stretched from Tunisia to Bahrain into one group. They have very different motivations, very different roots. The one common feature in all these uprisings, as I like to call them, was economic discontent. And if you look at the World Bank figures for unemployed young people, highly educated, in their 20s and 30s, no prospects of a job. They're looking at these elites, some of them dictatorships, creaming off the goods for the money for themselves. And of course, that leads to widespread unrest.
Right.
But I think a lot of Western governments have misinterpreted what is going on, and certainly the British Foreign Office, which is full of Arabists, should know a lot better than to go run around backing events which ultimately have led to dictatorships being replaced by other dictatorships.
Shashank.
Well, first of all, the Morsi government was increasingly autocratic and exclusive, but it wasn't a dictatorship. It was democratically elected, and the basis on which it operated, the constitutional framework, the legislative branches, were five successive votes that were held pretty freely and fairly. I think the real point here is, imagine these massive crowds we saw over the past few days voting in droves and discrediting the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. That's what we should have wanted to see. That's what we should have brokered.
And that's what the military coup has denied.
And a coup has denied the people of Egypt the chance to do that. And it was overly hasty. It was a 48-hour ultimatum. We were met. Morsi's cabinet was falling apart around him. His allies were defecting. Even other Islamists and Noor Salafists, Jamaa Islamiyah, who are extremists, by the way, were saying we want early elections. That was the way to achieve this transition. And if the Arab Spring has been frustrated, in large part it is down to the remnants of the old regime. In Egypt they're called the Falul. In Syria, of course, it is still the regime resisting.
So do you think the military cynically jumped onto this protest and used it as an opportunity to...
One legitimate theory is that they were concerned that had Morsi been overthrown by purely popular means or been forced into further compromise, it would have squeezed the military out of its privileged position as well. And of course, if we look at the last time they ruled, I'm afraid they showed absolutely no interest in shepherding Egypt towards democracy, and they ruled conducting actually what I would consider to be more egregious abuses of human rights than that which we've seen under the Morsi administration.
Con.
Well, I'm not convinced by this argument that the fresh elections would resolve the political crisis. The problem with Egypt is the two most influential bodies are the Muslim Brotherhood and the military. The more secular groups are very badly organised, very ineffective. And I'd have thought the way things were going and the reason the military has intervened is that had Morsi gone without military intervention, we'd have seen just somebody else from the Muslim Brotherhood, arguably of a more Islamist hue, replacing him.
Well, I think Morsi, having governed as he did, ran the economy into the ground, really shown his true colours, and I think the Brotherhood has suffered grievously from this. There's no prospect a Brotherhood candidate would have been able to or can now win a presidential election. Now, parliamentary elections, that's a different question. They have strong grassroots support. But I think you raise a really important point, Con. What happens now? Because, of course, the roadmap that the army's put ahead is more elections, exactly what you say wouldn't have worked. So where do we go from here? You can't squeeze out the Brotherhood, and what you certainly can't do is squeeze out the Islamists, who, by the way, go well beyond the Brotherhood. So what do you do? I mean, if you squeeze them out, we are looking at a scenario not necessarily of Algeria in the 90s. I wouldn't go that far. This is a very different situation, but of real serious division, and the army will then have to choose. Do we step in and arbitrate these disputes, many times violent, as we've seen in the past few days, attacks on the Brotherhood, or what? Do we just stay in charge forever and continue to run Egypt into the ground as we did last time we ran the country?
See, the problem here is that it's not just the recent history of Egypt we're struggling with. Really, since the Nasser Revolution, Egypt has been denied the political institutions, the breadth of political discourse to give it a chance of a workable democracy. And this is why I'm very deeply sceptical about all this talk of democracy, because you can only have democracy when you've got the political institutions to support it. And I don't see that in Egypt, and which is why I think it's going to lurch from one chaos to another.
I infer from what you're saying that we fundamentally can't trust many Arab peoples with democracy.
Well, I've seen democracy at work in Iraq, which is probably the only country with a functioning democratic constitution at the moment. And how democracy works in Iraq is if you're a candidate, you go and see a tribal chief and you persuade the tribal chief to get his tribe to vote for you in return for various kickbacks. And that's democracy Iraqi style. You could say that's democracy Arabian style. Of course, Egypt's a far more developed country than Iraq, a far older country, and one would have hoped that they would be able to handle democratic processes better.
Okay, well, let me put out a counterexample. When the Velvet Revolution happened, that resulted in economic growth, in democracy. Those were countries that had experienced communism. Very few of them had experienced functioning democracies before that. They had very little civil society because of communism. And yet they transitioned to democracy very well. Why can't Arab countries do that?
Well, I think, Con, you're partly right in suggesting tribal links in places like Iraq have played into that. Also, of course, sectarian divisions. In Iraq, you have a strong winner-takes-all culture of politics. And so there is a legitimate fear that this is majority Shia rule and Sunnis can only respond through violence. And so those sectarian divisions, of course, didn't exist in the same way in Eastern Europe. But actually, I completely agree, Tim, the underlying principle that no country is immune to this. And I look at India as well, which in the 1940s, extremely poor, extremely local, provincial, village-based, and everyone thought democracy can't possibly survive.
Torn apart by sectarian divisions.
And at the end of the day, 60 years later, Indian democracy is deeply flawed, but still in many ways flourishing. And I think it eventually will come to Egypt. Look, it took us 100 years to go over this parliamentary arc. It will take Egyptians a hell of a long time.
One final question. Con, what can the West learn from all of this?
I think the West needs to tread a lot more carefully in dealing with the challenges that are taking place throughout the Arab world. At the time, I was very critical of the British government, of William Hague and David Cameron, for openly supporting the overthrow of President Mubarak when they had no clear idea what would replace him. And I think if we are going to engage with these challenges, then we need to be far more realistic than we've been in the past.
Shashank?
I think the answer here is to make sure we put enormous pressure on the military to make sure what they do is not repeat the mistakes made by the Brotherhood. That is, don't rush a constitution through, don't exclude opponents, and above all, hold them accountable for the abuses they commit, just as we want to do so for the Islamists.
Shashank Joshi and Con Coughlin, thank you both very much. On the same day that we read about austerity for the next 20 years, Waitrose and Marks and Spencers have released surprisingly lavish Christmas menus. Steve Hawkes, who is our consumer affairs editor, has taken a look at them. What's on them?
Incredibly indulgent, incredibly innovative food that you just wouldn't see, you wouldn't expect to see, basically. It was 9 o'clock in the morning. Was quite early to be eating lavish Stilton, but that was what was on show at M&S. You had incredibly innovative chocolate cakes. You had this collection of amazingly fabulous personalities chocolates. You had salmon wrapped in gold leaf, salmon with mulled wine.
And this is Christmas food.
This was Christmas food.
Right, okay. So old-fashioned turkey and Brussels sprouts, that's out.
With a twist. With a twist. Sugar plum sauce on it, that sort of thing. And a lot more game. We're turning to a lot more game now. M&S is doubling its range of game. You're going to have wood pigeon for the first time this Christmas.
Is it very expensive?
It is quite pricey. If you look at Waitrose, Heston Blumenthal obviously has a tie with Waitrose and he's launching his first ever range of party food. Obviously, the adverts you see coming up to Christmas, sausage rolls coming out the oven, not a Waitrose. You're going to get mini chili con carne puffs, mini ham, tureen and piccalilli party food for £7 a pop. And I think what it tells you is that this two-speed economy we've been looking at since the credit crisis has now sort of moved into food. Waitrose was saying yesterday they definitely believe the economy is ticking up. Their shoppers are putting a bit more in the basket. They're beginning to spend a bit more. M&S seem to be doing well. And it seems to suggest that this section of the economy we've always sort of known about. They've got the two oldest types of shopper, about 53, 54 years old.
Right.
They're doing okay.
They are the posher kind of supermarket, aren't they? I mean,
they're definitely the top two in terms of where you'd expect to see the priciest food, the most lavish food, the most indulgent food.
Right.
The Waitrose
and a lot of own brands as well.
Yeah,
I noticed that. That's why I don't shop there. Because that's not a personal statement. I'm not saying they're bad. I'm just saying I like to buy cheap branded rubbish, but I can't get that at M&S. It's all posh, home
branded.
Where'd
you go for cheap branded rubbish?
I don't want to get into the business of naming any particular shops. I mostly just order at home, or else it's a tin of soup and a can or whatever Mum brings around in the evening. So the higher end of supermarkets, the Marie Antoinette brand of supermarkets, they're doing well, but also the very low end.
Yeah,
is
it's
doing
just what
well.
We're seeing now. traditionally in Britain you had four big supermarkets, three big supermarkets, even Tesco, Sainsbury's, Asda, Morrison's, that had the game to themselves. Waitrose have come along in the past decade. M&S has dabbled in food, and it's very strong in food, obviously. But now what you've seen is the hard discounters. Aldi, Lidl, Iceland, mm-hmm. I'm sure you know about. They do brands. They're beginning to pick up steam. Aldi and Lidl, the credit crisis has... They've now arrived, basically. They'd always struggled before the credit crisis. Now people have gone to Aldi and Lidl, the hard discount stores, the cheapest you can get, but also they have quite a bit of quality. You've got this dumbbell effect. At the lower end of the spectrum, you've got chains like Aldi, Lidl. Their sales are going up by about 20% year on year, which is incredible. Then you've got the other end, Waitrose and Marks and Spencer's doing well. Waitrose is growing about 10% at the moment year on year, M&S 6%, which is huge for food. And then the traditional stores, the Tesco's, the Asda's, the Morrison's, they're struggling a bit more in the middle. And I think what you're seeing is the credit crisis has made it okay to go and shop at Aldi, and people have gone there and
right.
they thought, okay, this is quite good, this is all right, actually, it's a bargain. And at the other end, people, Waitrose, M&S, people are trading up, give it issues over traceability, over product quality. People believe, perhaps with some justification, that if they go to Waitrose, the food, they can trust it more.
So now, does this mean either that some people are getting richer and some poorer, so it's all being driven by economics, or does it mean that tastes are changing?
I think it's both. I think economics is obviously a key part in it, but I think taste is another part of it as well. M&S yesterday kept saying that in their food, what they're doing, people want the basics. They want the smoked salmon, they want pork pies, they want the basic Christmas fare, but they want a twist with it.
Right.
Like, say, for example, this sugar plum flavouring they've dropped on everything. They want little subtle changes. And you're seeing that also in the drinks industry. Lager is falling out of fashion. You're seeing a lot more people now.
Really?
Yes. The cask ale trade, speaking to Britain's biggest pub group yesterday, cask ales now make up about 20% of what they sell, which is double a decade ago. The palate is changing. People are looking for something. If they're going to spend money, they want to spend something that they can taste, they can enjoy. Cider's come up. Cask ale's come up. It's no longer good enough to have that cooking lager. Certainly you're looking at me quizzically like you enjoy it. But people are seeking a bit more of a punch for the pound they spend.
Right, right. Now, that makes perfect sense. So in a time of austerity, people aren't necessarily actually spending less. They're just spending in different ways more carefully on something they think is worth it.
You heard this phrase a few years ago, the savvy shopper, that people are looking online and looking at what bargains they can get. And then they're going out and spending their money. For example, people go into a store and they think nothing now of talking to a shop assistant, finding out how a product works, going home and ordering it from a rival because it's cheaper.
Right.
That is now enshrined in the way we shop. And with food, you're seeing that, and I think in drink, you're seeing that, and that's going to continue.
Steve Hawkes, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For more opinion and commentary, you can find us at telegraph.co.uk.